Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I'm going to take just a moment before we get started today to thank all of our listeners and our guests and everybody who has contributed to the success of this podcast. We're not done with the month of July yet, but we have already had more downloads of this podcast this month than ever before. We've crossed more than 1.65 million. And that means a lot to me. Let me, you know, I think I told the story before that there was a time before we started this podcast that I was doing some pilots for a major public radio station. Actually, it was WNYC, and we came up with some great pilots. And I think I've told the story before, but I asked the program director what his expectations for a podcast at a station like that would be, and he said a million downloads a month. And I remember that I don't know whether I audibly gasped or just internally gasped something. A million downloads a month? Are you kidding? Of course, you would have the incredible power, the promotional muscle of public radio in a city like New York. So it was certainly possible. But I just remember what a massive challenge that was. And I've always kept that in mind. And so when we, the first time that at the Bulwark that we passed a million downloads a month, it was quite a milestone, and we have just blown past that. I don't know what we're going to end up with, whether we'll ever hit 2 million a month, but I really do appreciate that. And I was looking back at the month of July, and obviously, you know, we're in the middle of a presidential campaign. We're in the middle of one of the weirdest years ever. I think that people are going to look back on this year and go, so how did you get through 2020? But in any case, in the month of July, this is who we've talked to so far. We talked with former Ambassador John Bolton, Mona Charon, who's one of our colleagues, columnist A.B. Stoddard, Josh Kroschauer from the National Journal, Yasha Munk, who just started up his own publication devoted to free speech called Persuasion, Professor Julian Zelizer, who is out with a new book on Newt Gingrich, Rachel Bitticofer, who is a very well-known political analyst. Though we, of course, have had Jonathan Lass, Sarah Longwell, Bill Kristol on a couple of times, Benjamin Wittes from Lawfare, Elena Plott from the New York Times talking about the fall of Jeff Sessions. We've had Jonathan Allen from NBC News, our own Tim Miller, of course, author and professor Daniel Dresner, of course, the author of the book about Trump the toddler, Amanda Carpenter, Jake Tapper, former Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill, Kim Whaley, who is our resident constitutional expert, yesterday Rick Tyler, and I mean this week Rick Tyler, and columnist Matt Lewis. And today, one of our most frequent guests makes his first appearance apparently in the month of July, David Priest, the Chief Operating Officer of Lawfare. So welcome back on the podcast, David. And maybe you'll be the one who'll push us over like 1.7 million this month.
What a great list to be a part of, Charlie. That's such a range of people working on different things that all center around, you know, your issue space, but from so many different angles. That's a real credit to you and the team.
Well, you know what? I've said this before, but one of the things I really enjoy about this podcast is that every day I get to sit down and have an interesting conversation with interesting people. Well, at least it's interesting to me. And we do mix it up. And I know a lot of other podcasts will stick with an existing cast, you know, the same people. And I appreciate that. And I understand the attraction of that. And maybe at some point we will do that because it's sort of like, okay, what does this group of people say about the issues? And you have a cast of characters. And I find that very, very attractive. But I also find the range of people, just different people, different attitudes, different ideas, and different styles. And if you do something on a daily basis, I think that helps. So, and again, thank you.
It certainly is nice as a listener because, you know, I get to hear from, you know, Julie, you get to hear from a political science professor talking about Wisconsin politics and how it's evolved. And then the next day you get to hear from John Bolton. And then the next day you get to hear from a reporter with breaking news that they are going to put into context. And it all centers around issues we all care about and have to be focused on, but that variety really helps. So thanks for what you're doing.
Well, it helps to keep it fresh, I think, a little bit, because otherwise we're talking about the same thing over and over and over. It does feel like that. I mean, you know, how many times can you say the orange man is bad, even though the orange man is bad, right? So, and I think you continue to be the most frequent guest that we've ever had on the podcast. So thank you for that. Okay, let's start with this. Let's start with the crazy on all of this. We have officially entered the demon sperm phase of the Trump presidency, and I am not making this up. So I in my newsletter, I start with the headline in the Daily Beast: Trump doubles down on demon sperm doctor, which is almost David. I mean, this makes me nostalgic for, you know, those kinder, simpler times when we just had the president talking about bleach enemas, you know, and getting UV rays inside the body. So you have the president who has been tweeting out these videos of some of these doctors who are pushing various bizarre theories about the coronavirus, including obviously the, you know, hydroxychloroquine, which he's still obsessed with. But the one he's most enthusiastic about is this Stella Emanuel, who has, you know, basically said, you know, this drug is a cure, masks aren't necessary. But the reason we're starting with her is she has these weird ideas about alien DNA and demon sex. This is from the Daily Beast. She has often claimed that gynecological problems like cysts and endometriosis are in fact caused by people having sex in their dreams with demons and witches. She alleges alien DNA is currently used in medical treatments and that scientists are cooking up a vaccine to prevent people from being religious. And despite appearing in Washington, D.C. to lobby Congress on Monday, she has said that the government is run in part not by humans, but by reptilians and other aliens.
So what's weird about that, Charlie?
The last one, she may have a point. There may be. So the president of the United States is tweeting this stuff out. Yesterday, he holds a briefing and he calls her very impressive. And, you know, I mean, we're in the midst of this pandemic. 150,000 Americans have died, and the president decides to take this detour into the worst neighborhoods of Crazy Town. And let me just play the audio. This is how it went. Caitlin Collins of CNN asking the president about the crazy.
The woman that you said was a great doctor in that video that you retweeted last night said that masks don't work and there is a cure for COVID-19, both of which health experts say is not true. She's also made videos saying that doctors make medicine using DNA from aliens and that they're trying to create a vaccine to make you immune from becoming religious.
Well, maybe it's the same, maybe it's not, but I can tell you this. She was on air along with many other doctors. They were big fans of hydroxychloroquine, and I thought she was very impressive in the sense that from where she came, I don't know which country she comes from, but she said that she's had tremendous success with hundreds of different patients. And I thought her voice was an important voice, but I know nothing about her.
Masks don't work. Yeah, go ahead, Paul. Last week, real quick.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
And he walked out.
And then he walks out.
Yeah.
And he just leaves. So, yeah. David Priest, you want to take a shot at this?
I mean, where to begin?
Yeah, right.
We keep saying, you know, every few months that, you know, the best fiction writers couldn't come up with this. They'd be laughed out of the room. At this point, he's praising a doctor who I believe YouTube has had to remove videos for false and misleading content before, and says, well, he doesn't know much about her, of course, can't say what country she's from, which I don't know why that's relevant, but says, you know, her credibility is because she claims she's had tremendous success with hundreds of patients while claiming reptilians are running the U.S. government. Alien DNA is being used in experiments. The fact that that doesn't faze the president, that he treated that like a normal question and responded to it with his normal pacing and his normal kind of defense, is just absolutely shocking that he didn't even register the absurdity of the moment.
Because it doesn't matter to him. As long as she's supporting him, everything else doesn't matter. I mean, this is the thing, is if she's useful to him, if she says something positive about him, he's willing to overlook everything else. And this is, by the way, is the scary thing. I mean, there's several scary things. Number one, you would hope the president of the United States would have some sort of a filter to say, this is credible, this is not credible. I want to listen to person A, but not person B. This president does not have that. He will take any bullshit that comes over the transom. Number two, maybe I've lost track of the numbers here, but you know, there are a lot of Americans. I'm sorry to say this. There are millions of Americans who take some of this stuff seriously, not the alien DNA, but the you don't need to wear masks, the various other conspiracy theories. And this stuff coming from the president of the United States is kind of a doom loop, because we want to get past this pandemic. And the way to do that is to, you know, behave in the most responsible way possible. And here you have the president basically bringing up one crazy idea after another.
Well, you know,
yeah, people listen to this, Marlene, stuff.
You know, maybe we need to check ourselves. Maybe we're being too negative about this. I mean, if our mutual friend Tom Nichols were here, who's been arguing for the need for the president to listen to experts for years, he would say at least the president is listening to an expert. It happens to be an expert on sex with an incubus and a succubus and alien DNA and all the mysteries that, you know, big government doesn't want you to know, supposedly. But at least he's listening to somebody who is has a doctor before their name. That's something. Unfortunately, it goes in the wrong direction there. But to me, this is emblematic of so much. It says a lot about Trump, and you're right. It says a lot about him championing anyone who seems to be supporting him or what he wants to hear, but also the disregard for anything other than his own prospects. The fact that being president and somehow implying that this is okay in the most scientifically advanced country in human history, even if only a few people give that credence, even if only a few people change their behavior because of it, this is absolutely unacceptable beyond many of the other things we've talked about.
Okay, so I know it's obnoxious to read my own stuff, and I'm just going to confess this, but in my newsletter this morning, because I am stuck on this one thought here, and this is what I wrote. I said, look, if you met somebody randomly who was peddling these kinds of crackpot notions, you would, number one, you'd try to talk some sense to them maybe, right? Or number two, if you thought they were too crazy, you would avoid them. And three, you'd make sure they didn't get near your kids. What you would not do is, number one, hire somebody peddling this kind of crap as the principal of your child's school. You wouldn't make them a CEO of an important business. You wouldn't let them perform surgery on you, right? If your doctor came in spouting this kind of stuff. And you definitely wouldn't give them 4 more years as president of the United States. I mean, this is the thing. Imagine if you met somebody else who just like randomly came in and started saying, hey, you really ought to listen to this video, even though this woman thinks this sort of stuff. It is crazy. So,
I think you're right about that in your listing of what a normal person would do, but the ground has been laid for this. Now, it's in the entertainment realm, but you can flip through cable TV on any night and you can find shows like Ancient Aliens and other pseudoscience shows that scientists and skeptics have railed against for years because they at least give the aura of truth. You have someone who looks authoritative. Sometimes they do have a title before their name, but it's not related to the matter of science they're talking about. But they will say things, usually caveated with language like, well, we don't know exactly how the Egyptians built the pyramids. So maybe aliens helped them. But then they go on and talk from that springboard about how aliens could have influenced it. This has been permeating the American consciousness now for more than a decade. And some of these ideas, which most of us see as possibly entertaining, mostly annoying, but when that is actually given a platform to be seen as something worth discussing in a rational debate when 150,000 Americans are already dead, that is a step way too far.
This is a really good point. I'm glad you made this, because one of the things that I think a lot of people missed about Donald Trump was the way he was being introduced to tens of millions of Americans through the fake reality TV show of The Apprentice. So stuff like this actually does matter. And there is a lot of this out there. Actually, I was interviewed this morning by somebody from Britain who wanted to know about One America Now network. And he was saying, so is there, you know, why are they doing, why is this network, this new network, why is it peddling conspiracy theories? Is it a business decision? What's behind it? And my response kind of off the top of my head was, because they know that there is a critical mass of people who are an audience for this sort of thing, that there may be 30, 40 million Americans who, you know, have been swimming in this fever swamp of conspiracy theories online, who, are a potential audience for a network that is willing to go there. I mean, you know, Fox News is Fox News, but there are at least some, you know, guardrails. So what if you flank them to the, you know, you flank them not only by going to the right, but going to the crazy right? Might you become the go-to place for tens of millions of people who look at QAnon and go, hey, that makes sense. Alien sperm. Well, and maybe, yep. Who knows, you know?
So what I'm looking for is scary. The Republican leadership in particular, because the president is nominally a Republican. I'm looking for the Republican leadership that comes out and says, no, you know, this, yes, you can do things like policies that we might not agree with, or you can do things like tweet when we wish you wouldn't. But when you're promoting pseudoscience and laughably bad assertions that could impact the lives of people, that's just not acceptable. Let's talk about truth. Let's not put a platform up there for someone to spread misinformation and disinformation about issues like this. And if something is laughably bad as demon sex and reptilian aliens and alien DNA and experiments, if that isn't the threshold, then we get into that, you know, Bill Kristol, David French debate about, you know, do you burn down a party that refuses to condemn this?
Well, I mean, that's what makes it so great that the Senate Republicans issued that very, very strong statement pushing back on the president's misinformation this morning, which they didn't.
I mean, you're in your own alternate reality.
That's never going to happen. Okay, so moving on from alien DNA and demon sperm, the president sat down with Jonathan Swan from Axios, who asked him about whether or not, well, asked him about the whole issue of Russia allegedly paying the Taliban a bounty to kill American troops, and whether or not he'd raised this question with Vladimir Putin. And here's a little segment of this back and forth, Jonathan Swan and Donald Trump.
It's been widely reported that the US has intelligence indicating that Russia paid bounties, or offered to pay bounties, to Taliban fighters to kill American soldiers. Right. You had a phone call with Vladimir Putin on July 23rd. Did you bring up this issue?
No, that was a phone call to discuss other things. And frankly, that's an issue that many people said was fake news.
Who said it was fake news?
I think a lot of people, if you look at some of the wonderful folks from the Bush administration, some of them, not any friends of mine, were saying that it's a fake issue. But a lot of people said it's a fake issue.
There was
we had a call talking about nuclear proliferation, which is a very big subject, where they would like to do something and so would I. We discussed numerous things. We did not discuss that, no.
And you've never discussed it with him?
I have never discussed it with him, no. I'd have no problem with it.
But you don't believe
but you know,
the intelligence.
It never
it's because you don't believe the intelligence. That's why.
Everything, you know, it's interesting. Nobody ever brings up China. They always bring Russia, Russia, Russia. If we can do something with Russia in terms of nuclear proliferation, which is a very big problem, bigger problem than global warming, a much bigger problem than global warming in terms of the real world, that would be a great thing. No, it never reached my desk. You know why? Because they didn't think it was intelligence. They didn't think it was real.
It was in your written brief, though.
They didn't think it was worthy of it. I wouldn't mind. If it reached my desk, I would have done something about it.
Okay, David, you have a little background on things that reach the president's desk. We've talked about this before.
Yeah.
Your reaction.
It's hard to know if anything in there is true. First of all, I do not remember a long roster of former Bush administration officials who came out and said this is obviously fake news. Number one, they don't have access to the current intelligence. So how would they credibly say this is fake news? Then the president says, well, it was never put on my desk. It was never brought to me. There's been reporting corroborated from multiple sources that, yes, this was presented in the president's daily brief. And if the National Security Advisor chose not to highlight it orally for the president, that reveals more about the president's method of taking intelligence than it does about what the intelligence community presented to him. And then third, his claim at the end there, which is absolutely bonkers, is him saying, well, if they would have told me about it, of course I would have done something about it. Really? But really, Mr. President? Because the intelligence community told you quite directly about Russian interference in the 2016 election and backed it up with the goods and the receipts and all kinds of technical information. And you have rejected that since day one. So don't pretend that if intelligence is put in front of you, that you will accept it and do something about it. That is, I would say, disingenuous, but I don't even know if he knows what he's saying.
Well, he certainly knows about it by now. I mean, whether they gave it to him or not, he's read about it, he's heard about it, he's talked about it. And so the question is, are you still not going to raise it with Vladimir Putin?
Well, sure. And
the normal functioning president, when he hears this sort of thing, wouldn't they pick up the phone and go, okay, what's the story here? Is it true? Is it not? What are we going to do about this? And, you know, once again, his failure to even bring it up, you know, time and again, they've asked, you know, well, did you talk to Vladimir Putin about interference in the election? Meh, not really.
Yeah, there are two real claims there. I mean, one is that he would say, well, it's not credible and it wasn't orally briefed to me, perhaps. We don't know for sure, but it wasn't emphasized for me. And that must be because they didn't deem it credible. So it's not worth doing anything on anyway. Okay, maybe. Even if he says we have to act sometimes on intelligence which is not fully verified, which is an accurate description of intelligence and policymaking, if we have to act in that realm, well, then he goes to the line of, but, you know, we kind of went after the Russians in Afghanistan after the Russian invasion. So, you know, what they're doing really isn't wrong anyway, which is a horrible backup. If that's your backup argument, you're in trouble. To me, there's no aspect of this that works. Anything from the president and how he takes intelligence to how the National Security Advisor and other staff in the White House ensure that the president gets information to the president's willingness to actually understand intelligence and use it to help decision making to his actual policy decisions. Nothing in here looks good. And the more he talks about it, the more it shines a light on that.
It does seem that this issue has faded from the spotlight. I know that Tammy Duckworth keeps tweeting out every day that it's been 32 days since the president has not addressed this. But this does seem like one of those stories that we just can't move on from, or that we should not just move on from. I do wonder why there has been not more, why there hasn't been more focus on this, why there hasn't been more congressional pushing for information on this. It does seem like the president is filibustering and just trying to run out the clock on what really ought to be a defining issue of his presidency.
Too many scandals, too many stories, too many outrages. Listen, we started this podcast by talking about demon sperm and not about Russian bounties on U.S. soldiers. So all of us fall prey to it. But I guarantee you, even if most media outlets aren't making this a top story every day, I know there's a group of people that care a lot about this and do remember this and are thinking about it every day. And that's our troops in Afghanistan, the ones who, according to the reporting, that the Russians are putting bounties on their heads and encouraging the targeting and killing of. This is something that they're not forgetting, and we would honor them best by not forgetting it ourselves.
No, you're right. And by the way, just sort of parenthetically here, we've described the political campaign, the number of days left. What is it now? It's we're at 90.
We're in the 90s.
We're in the 90s, and every day is sort of like a gold coin, and that every day that Donald Trump does not turn things around is a day that he's not going to get back. And I think it's safe to say that with a day dominated by the DNA sperm and his non-answer to that question, yesterday was not the day that the president began to turn things around. Okay, so Bill Barr shows up on Capitol Hill, very, very contentious hearing with House Democrats. I would say a couple of things. Number one, and you can tell me if you think this is unfair. I am struck by how bad a lot of them are at this questioning, how bad these hearings are. That's not true of every one of them. There were some who I thought were very, very pointed and put on some, you know, made some serious points here. But also, and I wrote this in the Bulwark, yesterday was also a reminder that Bill Barr was, in fact, worse than you thought. I mean, I was never a Bill Barr fan. I wrote a lot of stuff back in 2019 about why we shouldn't trust him. But his willingness to go full partisan hack yesterday, to spout the Trumpian bullshit, to basically recycle some of the misinformation, the very clear signal that all he cared about was the audience of one, it was really a striking performance, I thought. It didn't tell you anything you didn't really know, except to under, at least for me, but it underlined really, you know, how bad it is to have the personal Roy Cohn for Donald Trump sitting in the attorney general seat.
Yeah, there are several angles on this. I mean, he's getting a lot of attention for some of his answers, and we'll talk about a few of those. But for me, the two things that stood out the most, number one, how unapologetic, how unconcerned, really, the attorney general is with answering questions, giving full and complete answers, how unconcerned he is about appearing to be disdainful and completely unworried about what the congressional oversight means. Now, I think a part of that is the fault of Congress, is you have had many times when in this administration, but it is wider than that, but in this administration in particular, when you have had people refusing to testify, you have had people giving incomplete testimony, you have had people giving false testimony, and there has been no reaction, or there has been rhetorical reaction, but no actual concrete action against it. In that environment, if you're Bill Barr, why do you lean forward? Why would you possibly try to be agreeable? Because there's no penalty to not doing so. There's no penalty to being a jerk. So from his perspective, I completely understand it. There's almost nothing, and I still hold out the almost, but maybe I'll just go to nothing. There's nothing he could say or do in these hearings that would lead to an impeachment of the attorney general. There's no stomach in Congress for it. There's nothing he could say or do in these hearings in the era of demon seeds and incubuses that would lead the president to ask him for his resignation, unless he said something like, I disagree with Donald Trump. Maybe that would do it. The other side of it, of course, you brought up, which is the, you know, horrendous job that the vast majority of the representatives of the American people do in questioning. I don't know if they think it's a courtroom. I don't know if they think that they are being judged by their constituents on how many rapid fire questions they can ask without actually following up and getting to the core issues. But I was amazed that representative after representative, with only a couple of exceptions, were going in clearly with a list of the six questions they felt they had to ask. And they did not ask natural follow-up questions. They did not pair their questions with other representatives. They did not follow up on areas where it was obvious that the attorney general was obfuscating or otherwise failing to shed light on the most important issues. And it's embarrassing to say this, but you know, I worked in intelligence for years, and I saw people who were in training as intelligence officers who did a better job at asking questions, listening to the answers, and then asking follow-up questions that moved the story forward than some of these members of Congress who have been there for decades.
Yeah, no, I was struck by that as well. And of course, the limited time means that they can't really have the luxury of listening to the answers and parrying them. Also, I mean, it did make me wonder what would happen if you had professional staff attorneys who were asking the questions as opposed to the politicians. But
it could help, but then they wouldn't get their their clip.
Right, which is, yeah, they're never going to give that up.
I just thought it was Bill Barr said, because Barr had some real substantive issues here on everything from Portland to the election intelligence. The one that stood out for me was when he had a question about whether it was ever appropriate for a president to solicit or accept foreign assistance in an election. And Bill Barr's first reflexive answer was, it depends what kind of assistance. This is not a hard question. One would say, even though it was coming from a Democrat, this was, in a sense, a softball to Bill Barr to say, this is an easy one. You just say, no, it is not acceptable for a president to solicit or accept foreign assistance for his election. When pressed on it, when asked if it was ever appropriate for the president or a candidate to accept it of any kind, then Barr paused and said, no, it is not appropriate. But he clearly struggled with having those words come out of his mouth, even though that is the guidance from the Department of Justice and the FBI. It was a shocking moment.
No, it was. And what makes it more shocking is this is the second time that he struggled with that question. Remember, he did this last May. He was being questioned by Senator Chris Coons from Delaware, trying to get a straight answer. You know, if the North Koreans were interfering in the election or trying to, you know, pass information, do you agree with me that any campaign should immediately contact the FBI? And Barr famously hesitated for like 5 seconds, didn't say anything. He said, if it's a foreign intelligence service, yes. And so, you know, that's why you're absolutely right. This is a really easy question. Why not just snap out a quick reply and move on? What's the, you know, what's going through his mind? And you know what's going through his mind?
Yeah. I can't get inside Bill Barr's mind or inside anyone's heart, but it sure seems like he is trying to parse the language carefully to allow an important exception. And here's the exception that we already have on the table, which gives us a real sign of what he's probably talking about. He's talking about a foreign intelligence service being out of bounds for a presidential candidate to accept the help of a foreign intelligence service in an election. But that would certainly allow, for example, a president or a candidate reaching out to a country, let's say, I don't know, Ukraine, and saying, could you use your judicial system to dig up some dirt on an opponent? Because in our minds, we think that this other candidate has done some bad things, and we just want your government's help to investigate corruption in your country. And if it happens to mention that opponent, well, that's a legitimate law enforcement and investigatory action. I have a feeling that something around that is in Bill Barr's mind when he sits there for a second or two and thinks whether he can answer directly the question, is any foreign interference in an election okay? Because that kind of looks like foreign interference in an election, but it sure seems like he's trying to treat that as a legitimate investigation, which may have implications for the election. So he chooses to draw the line at a foreign intelligence service, which would mean all the other organs of any government that's not the United States would be okay.
Yeah. And of course, in his mind, he's also thinking, how can I answer this question without ticking off the, you know, the boss?
Well, I think that's the primary consideration. He's not too concerned about not ticking off the member of Congress asking him the question. That's for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So let me put you on the spot here. Okay. So who's the dumbest member of Congress?
Oh, no.
Come on. Well, it's easy.
I struggle with this one, Charlie, because I disagree with, well, almost every member of Congress. I just disagree with almost everybody because we all have different views on different topics.
No, I mean,
necessarily think they're stupid because I disagree with them. Right. Okay,
Louis Gohmert is the right answer.
You know what? I feel a little bit sorry saying that because my understanding is that there's reporting out today as we're recording this that he has tested positive.
Well, that's why I'm bringing it up, because he has been so militant in refusing to wear a mask. Right. And he's testing positive for coronavirus, and it's Louis Gohmert. So, yes, I suppose that'll be more compassionate.
As a human being, I still feel bad mocking somebody who has a life-threatening condition. But yes, he put himself in that position and was very proud of
others. And he put others in, and this is part of the misinformation. I mean, these things have real-world consequences here.
Yeah.
Okay. So the other thing that Bill Barr, I want to move on from this, but in terms of substance, he suggested that that the report is the report on, what do we call this, Obamagate, or the investigation into the beginnings of the Russia probe, that is going to, that he sort of suggests it will come up before the election.
Right. Yeah. He's definitely planting the seeds for maybe not even an October surprise. I mean, maybe it's going to be days before the election of something that he can construe as devastating to the opponents of President Trump. We certainly saw this with the Mueller report. He came out of the gate and spun it in the most positive light possible, even misrepresenting aspects of it. And I mean, prompting Bob Mueller to famously come out and say, you did not characterize the report accurately. There's nothing happened after that that would have convinced the attorney general he should not do that again. That is, there was no punishment. There was no cost to him of having done so. In fact, you could say it was the opposite. So I certainly don't rule that out. Here's the reason, though, that I think it might be less impactful than it otherwise would have been. If they do something like release an investigation, which probably doesn't find much, but if it does, and they spin it in the most damning light possible, there are a couple of dynamics this year that are different. Number one, they've done this trick before, and they've done it right. again and again, and it loses its impact each time. Not to say it won't have impact and shouldn't be condemned, but if that's done, my suspicion is it has a much smaller impact than each of the successive scandals that have been brought up. Number yeah. two, you actually have a case here where voting is different. It used to be that if you did an October surprise, you would give a matter of a few weeks for people right before they're making their decisions on their vote, and then go and they make their selection at the polling place. This year, you're going to have a massive number of people who are early voting or have already mailed in their votes. So if you try to pull a surprise just a few days before the election, it's going to have a much smaller impact than it ever has before, right. especially yeah. given the polling showing that there are many people who say there's absolutely nothing that could happen that would make me vote for the incumbent. In that case, when the undecideds are a little bit smaller, you have multiple dynamics saying, yes, they could certainly try to pull something by announcing an investigation and spinning what it actually finds, but the impact may be smaller than we think.
I think you're right about that. And of course, we're talking about this upcoming report from U.S. Attorney John Durham on the origins of the Trump-Russia investigation. It came up, of course, as the Justice Department allegedly has a policy against interference in the presidential race. I think based on the Comey precedent, but Barr made it clear that, he doesn't think that that policy is going to apply to that. So we can probably expect to see the Durham thing. My guess is that it will drop, and that it the average swing voter is not paying that much attention to this particular issue. By the time this goes, there's going to be so much else going on here. And of course, then you have to sort of imagine that there are these mythical swing voters who will say, well, I was going to vote against Donald Trump because of 200,000 coronavirus deaths. But if somebody named John Durham thinks that there was impropriety in the FBI investigation, well, then by God, I'm going to yeah. Turn around and change my vote. Look, this is going to play big on Fox. It'll play big on the conservative media world, but those people are already motivated and they're already locked in. And I don't think it makes a choice. By the way, speaking of polls, very interesting column in the Washington Post by Henry Olson. I cite him because he has been very Trump curious. He's been very friendly to Trump. He will often run interference for Trump, and I've kind of dinged him for it. But when he writes about polls, his stuff is really, really solid. And he has a piece saying, hey, Republicans, these polls are as bad as they look. Don't try to spin this. Don't try to pretend they're skewed. And he reminds us of one of the laws of polling, which is that as you get close to the election, undecided voters tend to break heavily against incumbents. So in 2016, Hillary Clinton was like a quasi-incumbent running for Obama's third term. And undecided voters broke very heavily against Clinton and for Trump. And he says, based on past experience, it's going to be the opposite this year, that if you're undecided in late October, you're likely to break against Trump, not for Trump. So Republicans can live in this bubble of denial, but the numbers are, in fact, as bad as they look.
They are. And here's the funny thing. We're going to start hearing a chorus of voices getting louder and louder over the next few months about polling not being accurate and fake news and all of this. The president has already done some of that. Whenever there's a poll he doesn't like, he'll just say it's a fake poll. That's okay. But they will pick up on this theme that's in the American psyche, that polling was wrong in 2016. Right. And that polling got the election wrong. And when you look at the actual data, polling didn't get the election wrong. Polling actually did a very good job at the national level. And when polling was done at the state level, when it was done, it appears to have been pretty good. Part of the issue is there weren't a lot of polls in some of the swing states right at the end to show some of the change. But polling overall did a pretty good job. is that people tend to focus on those national numbers. One thing that's heartening to me, at least on Twitter, and yes, I just said something was heartening on Twitter, is that I'm seeing more and more people pay attention to the state-by-state polls and less attention to the national polls, which effectively are useless. So when you see a poll in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Florida, in Texas, for God's sakes, when you see these polls that are showing where the race is at, that's what you pay attention to. And you realize that the polling tends to be pretty good in aggregate, and they are showing really bad poll numbers for the incumbent this time.
They do. And here's a new morning consult poll that answers a question that's been in the back of my mind, because I have thought, if Donald, let me put it this way, if Donald Trump does win, comes back and wins this election and we're trying to reverse engineer it, one of the issues that I think will have helped him will be a backlash, a suburban backlash against violence in places like Portland, right? I mean, clearly this is the Trump the Trump campaign's plan. They are sending in a lot of the federal agents in order to create the viral videos. They're going to put tens of millions of dollars behind the ads telling Granny, to be scared of this, that the anarchists are out there and that Joe Biden is going to appoint Antifa members to his cabinet and blah, 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 blah. I mean, that's aimed at the soft suburban votes. Well, this new poll out this morning shows or would suggest that, Trump's Portland strategy is not flying with suburban voters. 47% disapprove of the Department of Homeland Security deployment. 49% say the federal presence has done more to increase unrest. So at least at this point, there's no indication that that is getting traction in those suburbs where Trump and the Republicans are just getting killed this year.
I have a dark prediction, which I don't like to do, but I have a dark prediction, which is I think that the president and those around him will not see that as a failure of the strategy. They will see that as a failure of scale, and they will see that people think that what do suburban voters across America really care about two courthouses in Portland and the rights of people who certainly look like anarchists in Antifa. I don't think that it's working, but I don't think that they will take that as evidence that the strategy is wrong. I think they'll take that as evidence that the strategy has not been applied widely enough. And if we need to stir up chaos in order to get the message to sink in, that's my worry, is this is going, there are going to be other excuses to instigate violence or to respond to small cases of violence within a larger peaceful movement in order to try to boost election prospects.
You could be right about that, because these are folks who actually believe that the Lafayette Square attack, quote unquote attack, was a political winner. Yep. Okay, here's another thing that's sort of, leaving, there is this these economic issues that are still hanging out there, and they're going to play a significant role in this campaign. I, as a matter of policy, don't like to spend a lot of time talking about what Congress is doing in terms of the negotiations, because most of the negotiations are a kabuki dance, and they go back and forth, and then at the last minute they'll come up with a deal, right? So don't spend a lot of brain power worrying about stuff that's in legislation that's going nowhere. But I have to say, I am amazed at the disarray among the Republicans and the tone deafness of the things that are coming out. This is an election year. You have 150,000 Americans who are dead. You have tens of millions of Americans who are unemployed. You have a lot of folks who are really terrified about whether or not those unemployment benefits are going to go down. And this Republican bill that rolled out includes things like, for example, increasing the deductibility of business meals.
That's right. Yeah, let's let the steakhouses in New York and Washington get the benefit of some of this stimulus money while mom and pop shops across the country suffer.
That's Amanda Carpenter took a blowtorch to this. Say, how out of touch do you have to be to think that this is the response? Because you have a lot of people. Look, the mom and pop who are taking, or the single woman mother who's taking your kids to McDonald's is not going to be collecting these receipts to get a tax break. This is very specifically aimed at corporate America or these large pricey restaurants, and It is an indication of, though, how there is a real disconnect, I think, leaving aside Trump, disconnect between the problems of average Americans and what's going on in Washington. And it's almost as if the Senate Republicans have kind of given up. They're just kind of throwing stuff up against the wall.
Yeah. And I forgot it was Amanda who said that, but I loved her line about this idea for the deduction for business meals being a priority here. She said, calling this out of touch would be generous because it would imply that it was somewhere within the realm of actually being in touch. It's clearly not there. And to me, it does, like so many other things, it reflects the absurdity behind the policies here. It also reflects an interesting moment for the Republicans on the Hill, because you have had Republicans come out in the last 24 hours or so from different sides of the party, some of them from the almost libertarian side, some from the more moderate side, calling out parts of this bill, this proposal, as being questionable at a minimum and unacceptable at the most. Everything from focusing on this kind of thing to, why is there something like $1.7 billion for the FBI building downtown?
Exactly.
It feeds into previous stories that aren't worth getting into, but that is not what an emergency relief package for Americans who are out of work, who are suffering, and we forget because we're blessed, but many Americans don't have the food they need. And we are talking about putting money into an FBI building so that it's not torn down and competes with the Trump Hotel, or we're talking about deducting business lunches. I mean, come on, this is an insult to the people who are suffering.
It is an insult, and you wonder who the backlash will be directed against. And I think the answer is pretty clear. If you're the incumbent, you have to live with all of this, and you do wonder whether or not that disconnect between the president who wanted to drain the swamp and the president presiding over this sort of thing will register. I don't know at this point, but I just keep coming back to what every single person that I talk to about everything that's going on, at some point they'll say how exhausted they are by it, how just like, when is it going to come to an end?
Right.
And whether you think the country's on the right track or the wrong track, I think the please make it stop exhaustion vote is going to be huge. And I think that it's underestimated. And I think it's a huge problem for Donald Trump, because even people who might like some of the things he's doing, do you really want four more years of this? And one of the things that's interesting on Twitter is watching some of the folks who on the right, including some people who had been never Trump back in 2016, who decided that, no, you know what, I'm going to vote for Trump because of Gorsuch and because of Kavanaugh and because of a variety of other things. Watching them, you know, constantly go, oh, this is awful. This is awful. Oh, this is indefensible. But you know that they're still trying to rationalize voting for him. I know that there are some shy Trump voters, some people who are supporting Trump who are embarrassed to say it. I think there's also a hidden number of Trumpists who are going, you know what, I just can't, I can't imagine four more years of carrying water for this guy or defending this guy or rationalizing his behavior. I can't take it anymore either.
I would like to think so. I mean, we've talked before about the ratcheting effect here, that once you agree to sign on to something you disagree with, it ratchets in and you find excuses to justify it. It's psychology. You find reasons to justify what you've done. And so the next outrage is easier to justify because you've built in the reasons why something is a higher priority, ethically or politically. And I think that dynamic is going on. Does everybody have a breaking point? I would like to think so. I don't know. I suspect that many do not. Once you've rationalized your decisions, it's very hard to break out of that mindset. Finally, I also think politically there is a problem.
You've talked me out of my moment of optimism.
I'm sorry. That's what I do. finally, politically, I think there is something to what you're talking about with exhaustion, but it cuts both ways, Charlie, because on the one hand, if you are just fed up with, maybe it's like some members of Congress saying they're just fed up with Twitter and they don't like the president's style and they're just sick of it. It could be policy. It could be implications. It could be a pandemic running roughshod across the country. Whatever it is, if you get fed up with something and then something else and then something else and then something else, we'd like to think that that builds momentum for action. But it also can dull the senses. It can lead to somebody saying, you know what? I'm just so sick of this. I'm not even turning on the news anymore. I'm turning on right. Ancient Aliens, and I'm just going to watch that. And I'm going to hope that it all goes away because I can't take it anymore psychologically. So you could have the effect cutting both ways. You could have adding up and motivating people to vote and be done with the circus. Or it could be people saying, I'm so sick of the circus that politics is a word that won't be uttered in this house anymore. We're just going to put our heads down and focus on our family and our neighborhood, and I'm not going to even vote. That's my concern.
Well, actually, that's a legitimate concern, because that's actually a tactic that we might see, which is that if you throw so much toxic crap into the environment, and at this point, if Trump knows that he's losing, he's behind, you just throw as much ugly stuff out there as possible, in sort of hoping that people will see it as being just too poisonous, too radioactive, and they just bail out on it. You suppress the vote by being as vile as possible. And this in fact can happen. Okay, one last thing in the moment we have left. Reading a lot of the tea leaves, which could maybe wrong. Lots of sort of random data points suggesting that Kamala Harris is going to be the VP choice. Somebody took a picture of some of Joe Biden's notes yesterday where he's saying nice things about him. There was a premature posting of something on Politico that she had been chosen, but that could have been, you know, a placeholder. There were reports that, wait, we saw them getting their pictures taken together. So I don't know. You want to go out on a limb? Do you think it's going to be Kamala Harris, or do you think all of this is just a misdirection?
I think that the signs are pointing that direction, but Joe Biden probably would have similar cards with nice things to say about all of the women on his list. He's not going to be out there disparaging or minimizing the credentials of anyone. Kamala Harris, I think for months has had not the commanding position, but certainly she has been among most people watching this carefully in the top one or two of potential candidates because of what she brings. She has campaign experience, and although her campaign did not do that well, she has experience on the campaign trail and can speak. She has prosecutorial experience. Obviously, she has experience in the Senate, and she has name recognition without massive negatives. That said, her campaign did not do well, and you would be selecting somebody not in the tradition of Ronald Reagan selecting George H.W. Bush, someone who gave you a strong challenge and finished number two, but you'd be picking somebody who dropped out of the race because they couldn't win a primary.
Well, sort of like Barack Obama picking Joe Biden, who was a terrible candidate before this year.
Well, he was, but in a sense, there was balance there, which was you had Obama picking Biden in large part because Obama was very young and relatively inexperienced for the job. And here's somebody who had literally decades of experience, including on the Foreign Relations Committee, to help balance the concern about a relatively new president. With Joe Biden, you don't have a lot of those things to balance in terms of his exposure and his experience. I think an interesting pick, someone who has moved up in the racking and stacking of late, is Susan Rice. Because when foreign policy issues aren't on the agenda, picking somebody who has been a national security person for her entire career doesn't seem that appealing. But at a time when you have a Russian bounties in Afghanistan story, you have trade war with China, you have the president announcing he's going to pull troops out of Germany, regardless of what Congress advises him. These issues are not going to be the primary things on the minds of most Americans. But having somebody there who can give the Americans an assurance of, you know, at least we have somebody who knows how the process is supposed to work and isn't going to do anything colossally stupid. If that's the argument that's made for Susan Rice, I think there's some merit to that. But I don't yet rule out Val Demings. I think she acquitted herself well in the impeachment hearings, and I think she's a strong candidate based on her personal background. Right now, I would not put my money on any candidate. I don't have the confidence. I would be happy to put your salary into that bet, though.
But did not any of your own money. Well, I don't disagree with you, except, you know, the Susan Rice thing basically brings Benghazi back into the campaign. I mean, as I think it was Michael Steele, former RNC chairman, who was asked about this, said that, you know, Republicans would lose their minds because they would just they would, you know, instantly go back to Benghazi and bringing that in. I think the most important thing is the person, has the person been vetted? The only really unforced error at this point for the Biden campaign is to choose somebody who becomes a distraction, somebody who has some sort of a skeleton in their closet. And the one advantage that Kamala Harris has being a former presidential candidate is she's been out there. And so she's been road tested. Susan Rice, I think you know what the skeleton is, Benghazi. But any of these other candidates, I just hope that they're doing thorough vetting, because we've seen how this goes south. What you don't need is, you don't need a game changing type thing where you find out that you got a Sarah Palin who's not only got the baggage, but got, well, has other issues as well. David Priest, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast and helping make this our record download month. Appreciate it very, very much.
You're welcome.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow. And we will do this all over again.